KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's see what we've got in store for our weather this holiday weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes from the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. We're taking a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We've got plenty of sunshine out there for you as we go throughout the day. Those temperatures will climb into the upper 30s for your Friday afternoon. The Heber Valley, look for hazy skies out there with temperatures climbing into the mid-40s as we go throughout the day. Hopefully this is the last day of the big time inversion, but we'll still have some haze likely extending into the weekend. Speaking of the weekend forecast, we're going to have temperatures dipping down into the teens as we get towards your Saturday morning in the Heber Valley. We'll see those temperatures dipping down to around 20 for us in the Park City area. High temperatures as we go throughout your Saturday afternoon will climb to near 40 degrees for your Saturday afternoon. In the Park City area, we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-40s for us in the Heber Valley. Once we progress towards your Sunday, look for lots of sunshine. We'll see those temperatures in the teens as we kick off the morning in the Heber Valley. Again, watching out for some, at least a little bit of haze still left around in the Heber Valley with highs in the upper 40s. We'll be in the mid-40s for high temperatures for us on our Sunday as we go towards your Park City area. Heading into next week, we've got more of this high pressure still sticking around across the area in some form or fashion. So we'll see those morning low temperatures in the teens in the Heber Valley. We'll see those lows in the 20s over towards the Park City area with highs in the mid-40s for us in the Park City area, highs in the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. Once we get into your Tuesday, look for temperatures in the teens and low 20s to kick off your morning with those highs into the mid-40s for us. As we get into the afternoon hours, could approach 50 degrees in the Heber Valley. And we'll be looking at highs in the 40s for the rest of next week for us in the Park City area with a few clouds trying to approach by the time we get towards next Thursday. Otherwise, the Heber Valley will have a mixture of clouds and sunshine, so we'll call it partly cloudy skies with lows in the low 20s with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s as we make our way towards the end of next week. Overall, more dry weather conditions and mild temperatures are expected. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Now let's see what that weather bodes for us in store for the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Drew with the Utah Avalanche Center. Morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning. You know, we've transitioned to an overall low avalanche danger across most of the state. There's a little bit of moderate avalanche danger in the western Uintas just outside of Park City, but we estimate the backcountry danger for, again, most of the state to be overall low danger. The snow is mostly stable. As always, we say that low danger does not mean no danger, that risk is inherent in mountain travel. If you are getting into the high country, keep an eye out for isolated and pockety hard slabs of wind-drifted snow and lead terrain, and we feel that the hard slabs overlying the persistent weak layer that has plagued us for much of the winter is mostly dormant. But again, as always, exercise caution if you're heading into the backcountry. If you need to burn some time, I have an essay just out called Is It Really Low Danger? And it provides an insight into how we end up ramping up our overall risk when we perceive things to be low danger. So a couple of human factors to consider before we head out into the Alpine today. So that's about it. We'll be out here tomorrow as well.
So, Drew, let me ask you, have you been out lately? I mean, is there much territory that's worth exploring these days with this weather?
Yes, you know, in fact, I would cherry pick a longtime Park City local, his guidebook, Dave Hanscom, mm-hmm. who pioneered a lot of the routes in the backcountry. He's got his books, Wasatch Tours, which volume 1, 2, and 3, published in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And they talk about something called a super tour that is just during periods of low avalanche danger and easy travel just to get out into the beautiful mountain range that we love so much and get up high and just enjoy those 5-star views. So, oh, yeah, it's worth getting out there and just enjoying the day.
All right, Drew, thanks, and have a good weekend.
Thanks so much. Same.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Hideout Mayor Ralph Severini. Then Park City Council Member Bill Sirocco will join us with a debrief from last night's significant council meeting, and he'll also give us a preview of next Tuesday's meeting. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Jack Gearhart, the CEO of USA Biathlon. Stay tuned. First, let's do a local news story.
Park City Council members approved a consent agreement in a 3-1 vote at their meeting Thursday. It promises to move the city toward a resolution in the long-running legal tussle over Matthew Prince's King Road Mansion. More specifically, the city is agreeing to ask the court to dismiss three pending lawsuits, which challenge the 11,000-square-foot home's height, floor area, roof design, parking area, and whether its design meets Park City's historic standards. Passage of the consent agreement is expected to clear the way for Prince, the CEO of cybersecurity company Cloudflare and owner of the Park Record, to get the building permit still needed to start construction. About two dozen locals were in the council chambers and online to comment ahead of the vote, many to protest it, but some in support. The biggest opponents are Prince's downhill neighbors, Eric Herman and Susan Fredston Herman. The Hermans are involved in two of the lawsuits the agreement could resolve. Since they weren't consulted, the Hermans say the agreement will just add another layer of litigation. Prince said the Hermans will still be able to litigate the issue if they want to. Council members said approving the consent agreement was a tough decision. But after almost 3 years of litigation, Councilmember Bill Sirocco said they want to move forward. He voted yes and urged the Prince family and the Hermans to seek common ground.
I want both parties to move forward. I want you to strongly consider, instead of investing and fighting each other, think about investing in the community and help bring us together.
Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
We'll hear more from Councilman Sirocco when he joins us a little bit later in the broadcast. He'll be talking about all the things that happened last night at last night's significant Park City Council meeting. But now big things are coming to Hideout. Here with an update on what's going on in Hideout is Hideout Mayor Ralph Severini. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Roger. thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about those big things. In December, as I understand it, the city and Larry H. Miller announced the Silver Meadows development in Hideout. Let's start with the big picture. What will that development entail?
Well, it's going to bring some amenities into the town, for one, and I just heard you live in 2A, so you're close by. You will partake, hopefully, in those amenities. And, you know, some of that's going to include a anchor grocery store, some retail, some restaurants. If you looked at the newsletter that we produced and the output, actually, there's a new website, silvermeadowsutah.com, that the Larry H. Miller Group put out within the last couple of months. And that shows some renditions, some of the ideas that they want to accomplish in conjunction with the town. Now, this has been around for a while. So, you know, Roger, this goes back to 2019, 2020. I was originally involved with co-writing the referendum for the town so that all the residents in Hideout could vote on it as opposed to just the council. I'm not sure I'll do a referendum again in my life, but it worked out. And during this period of time, there was also the case that came before the Utah Supreme Court. All that got ironed out, and now the Larry H. Miller Group are kind of like full speed ahead at the end of their design and into their execution.
So let's help our listeners understand exactly where this will be. As they're driving out 248, going under the underpass at 40, where will I see this new development when I cross into Hideout?
So if you're, there's two ways. If you're coming out Kearns Boulevard,
right,
and you're coming into 40 from that direction, there's a light there.
Right.
Make the right into Richardson Flat.
On Richardson Flat Road.
On Richardson Flat Road.
Okay.
And so if you pass where the parking lot is and where the bus pickup is, that's the area. The road may get moved around a little bit during the development, but that's the central part of it.
So it's very close to the Richardson Flat parking lot.
Correct. And there's 350 acres, and so a large parcel. There's upwards of 600 doors. And again, mostly it's about the amenities and the commercial that we really want, because we have nothing right now. Although we just passed a restaurant on 248 called Wild Horse. And that will be like a 3.5-4-star restaurant overlooking, the Jordanelle, looking out towards Deer Valley East Village. So hopefully, Roger, I'll see you there.
When will that get built?
All these developments are going to start within this 2026 time frame.
Okay.
So I can't say exactly, but this year.
So 600 doors. which I guess is some single family. That's all single family, or some of them are townhouses, apartments. What's the
mixed
mix?
Use.
It is a mix.
Yeah,
okay.
Mixed use plus the commercial, and then there'll be some amenities for the town. So the original proposal, there's always some modifications that can occur over time, but the original proposal included even a school, which that might not occur because, you know, five, six years ago, the population, the school age population here was totally different. And so, but we're talking about another town hall, perhaps, and a community center. So those kinds of centralized amenities that would complement the downtown commercial in that area.
So we're I'm listening to the scope of the development, but with 300 and some odd acres, will there be a significant amount of open space as part of this?
Yeah, and that's always built in by law, of course. And you want that open space as well for all those homes. And there's tons of land there. If you think about it, I know my daughter and her family live right close. So they live over at Retreat at Jordanelle. Mm-hmm. She's a school teacher and she's a big runner. And she uses that road in the areas, you know, the rail trail, et cetera, for, you know, her you know, walking and running. And so I think there's going to be plenty of opportunity to have more recreational. Maybe the other good piece is the Larry H. Miller Group is very focused on the integration of that area into both Park City and Deer Valley East Village. Look how that triangle's created. And, you know, so the best part about all this is not only will it create some amenities, but it will drive traffic back and forth between Deer Valley East Village and Park City.
Now, you mentioned that, and one of the things I read on the website, I think, was something about a possible chairlift. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that where that would go?
So I know it's hard to describe on radio here, but yes, there's a hill kind of like at the top of the area in the corner towards the Jordanelle Parkway. So if people know where that road is, we're talking about a gondola that would take you up there and then potentially transportation that would take you into Deer Valley East Village from the Jordanelle Parkway, potentially. So, and you could, if nothing else, you would have a fabulous view of the whole area by just taking the gondola up from the center of the area that will be developed.
And recognizing that it's hard, if one end of it is in the Larry H. Miller, the Silver Meadows development, where would the terminus be at the other end?
It would be,
it's up in
there,
the air, yeah.
But I'm not sure who, probably unincorporated Wasatch.
Wasatch County,
Or actually, it could be, I don't know, because that's where the border is between Summit and Wasatch. So, but I don't see that as, that's...
For it to be functional, I assume it would have to be within walking distance of East Deer Valley for it to make sense, right?
What do you mean, Roger?
I'm trying to understand. If one end of it is in the Silver Meadows development, mm-hmm. and you want to get on a piece of transportation to take you to someplace, what's the destination? What would be at the destination that would make you want to ride it?
Well, the destination could be, right now, it might be more scenic.
Okay, just a scenic envelope.
Yeah,
okay.
But the ultimate integration of these transportation systems, think about it. We would alleviate, a lot of this is about alleviating traffic. I just got off of Kearns Boulevard. You know what it's like, Roger.
Yes, sir.
If you're coming to 2A, you're just sitting in the traffic. So if you can eliminate or reduce some of that traffic and use that as a mechanism also for maybe ongoing public transportation that, you know, starting with a gondola and then adding some, you know, feeder system into either Deer Valley East Village or Park City or both, hopefully, you know. Well, we already have the buses.
Right.
So that takes you into Deer Valley and then potentially Park City. So, yeah, this could be a real hub. If you think about it, it is. Now, could we create some gondola-like transportation to further improve the access and entrances to Deer Valley East Village? That's almost what everyone I talk to in the campaign trail, for instance, and people I talk to in town, they would love that. They would love to have, I can park my car and just get off and get on the slopes. Maybe a little bit longer ride than if you were, you know, ski in, ski out. But, you know, that's some of the goals here.
So how long was did the negotiation with the Larry H. Miller Group take, and how did you find the experience?
Well, they're a great group to work with. Brad Holmes is the president of the real estate group. But if you look at the Larry H. Miller overall, have you watched the series called The Cities of Success that another station did not hear, but a national one? And they profiled Salt Lake, and they interviewed Peter Stark, who's the president or CEO, and along with the former governor and all the Silicon Slopes starting up. But, great organization. They've done the Bees, they've done the Royals, and they've done lots of projects like this. So I think we're very blessed. I don't know what other word to say to have a quality developer. And so we have weekly conversations. I have regular conversations with Brad and the entire team, trying to develop, trying to fine tune things, get things moving, and keep things on track.
Now, just so people understand where we are in the process, will there be further approvals needed, or are they basically in a position where they can start building? What has to happen next?
They could go right now, but if they want to make tweaks and modifications, they would probably come back either before the council or the planning commission, depending on what those changes are. But they are totally approved from the 2020 applications.
Is your sense that they'll start in the spring?
That's a tough one. I don't want to put words in the Larry H. Miller mouth, but
Let me ask it a different way. Would it surprise you if they started in the spring? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Sometime. It's going to be sometime in 2026. Okay. Don't hold me to this one, Roger. Right. But they want to move. Now, there's always issues around, transportation, UDOT, all those kinds of things, which can create, some time barriers.
I want to switch topics, unless there's anything else you want to touch on. I understand that a substantial percentage of the city's budget has been spent on legal fees. Why has that happened, and is it likely to continue?
Well, I hope it doesn't continue. Yes, from the past administration, I kind of inherited four lawsuits. We kind of have affectionate names for them, like the density case, the certificate of occupancy case. We just settled one, the impact fee case. These are all related to land use, just by the names of these nicknames that we give them, and they're all in. They're all related to our original founders and developers, Mustang Development. Mr. Bob Martino founded the town. So there were some issues that were, previously, caused whatever that was. I just want to get out of those. I think it's a waste of time for us to spend money on gargantuan legal fees compared to our budget. One, it doesn't provide a good brand for the town nor the developer and founder. Right. So I think now if we have regular dialogues, we'll try to move this along. We settled one case already in the last 2 months. Okay. So
what's going on with the fire station?
That is also on track. So we're in a temporary mode right now. And as you know, we're in the wildfire zone. So having a permanent fire station, which we have, but it's a temporary building housed in our shoreline area of town. And then they'll break ground. I was just on a call with Chief Hales the other day, and it looks like we'll, try to break ground towards the mid part of the year, towards the end of the year. And then that will be a, permanent station. And it will reside on 248 next to our claim development. So we have a little triangle acre and a half piece of land that the town owns. We've given it to the fire station, and they already have the architectural renderings, and they're ready to, go, I'd say, sometime in mid-year.
And I believe it was a year or two ago we had representatives of Hideout. I spoke to them, and there was fundraising activity going on. Have you met the fundraising goals for that fire station?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I'd have to ask Councilman Gunn, who drove
that.
That's
what it was, yeah.
Yeah, Councilman Gunn drove that initiative, mm-hmm. and as far as I know, we're fine. I don't think that's an issue at all. There were some issues about, egress and ingress because you're on 248 and meeting some UDOT standards, but I don't think there's going to be any big impediments that are, you know, from what we were talking about the other day.
Okay, before we go, any initiatives to improve safety on 248 that you want to get involved with?
Well, I'm already working on a regular basis with UDOT. So, you know, the Ross Creek entrance to the park, I think, Roger. And that area has already resulted. So when you come in from Park City and you're making that right turn into Shoreline, it's called Shoreline. That's the entrance to the to the park. And that's already caused some accidents, near misses, so to speak. So we've been talking to UDOT on a regular basis to either create a lane there, maybe even to move the road to where it joins with Deer Mountain Boulevard, and then have a four-way light, because they prioritize lights based upon four-way intersections. As you know, that's only a three-way intersection. Right. So we're working long-term with them. Short-term will be some digital signage and some right turn signs. So a combination of short-term, mid-term, long-term goals that we're on a regular call with UDOT.
Okay, Ralph, anything else you want to add before we go?
No.
Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
No, Roger, thank you.
We'll be right back after this. Well, my script says that Park City held a regular meeting last night at the City Council, but I think it was anything but regular. There was a lot of sort of emotion and activity in the room. Here with a debrief is Councilmember Bill Sirocco. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Roger. Good to see you this morning.
Okay. So the first item on the agenda that I tuned in for around 5:30 was the selection of the new council member. Before we get into what happened, can you remind us of the process that led to the appointment?
So I have a little bit of familiarity with this because I actually participated in it 4 years ago when Nan Worrell was elected mayor. She vacated her seat on council. And what the city does is they conduct an open application process. Anybody who's a Park City resident, so primarily inside the 84060 zip code, can apply. And as long as you lived in the city for 12 months or longer prior to the application date, you're entitled to be interviewed for a potential appointment to the city council.
And as I understand it, you had 9 applicants, and I believe earlier in the week, I listened to some of this, you interviewed them all.
Yes, we did on Tuesday. We, from about 10 a.m. to about 2 p.m., we interviewed all nine candidates, and then we had, you know, call it a little less than 48 hours or so to kind of sit, deliberate internally and then come to the meeting last night and figure out how we were going to move forward.
So just so our listeners understand, when you say deliberate internally, that might be heard to talk about you guys getting together and having a meeting. I'm not sure that's what you meant.
No, correct. I meant internally individually. Yeah, each of us individually, however each of us does that. For me, you know, it takes a lot of thought, reflection, a lot of thinking about the campaign season, the election results, both in the primary and the final election in November, and then weighing the pros and cons of what the implications of those things mean, and then trying to come up with making the best choice for the people, because, you know, it's not a democratic process, so to speak, in terms of there's no election to do fill this appointment. So I've really tried really hard to figure out what the will of the people was and tried to, you know, do my best to meet that.
And there was a fair amount of public input on this issue. Many of those people stood up and sort of argued that the appointment ought to go to Jack Rubin on the basis that he had received, had come within 7 votes of receiving the mayor's seat against Ryan Dickey. Obviously, one of the things we want to do on this broadcast is talk about what happened. But then I want to hear about your perspective of why you ended up where you were. First of all, can you describe what actually happened? How did it play out?
So with regards to the vote last night?
Let's do the vote.
Yeah. So originally there was going to be an open roll call in terms of voting, which would have meant that, you know, one person would have gone first, the next counselor would have voted second. Councilor Parisian, you know, thought that might handicap the process a little bit, create a little potential for gamesmanship, which, you know, is a fair concern. And so he requested that we do, that we do a ballot and all vote at the same time and then reveal the votes publicly, with attribution as to who voted for who.
So it was not an anonymous vote, but it was a written vote. It was interesting, as he said that last night, I was trying to think about the game, you know, as someone who's fascinated by game theory, I thought it was an interesting observation.
Yeah. Humans are humans. Like, if there's any sort of way to think about how things could work in more than one way, I mean, we're going to do it.
And so an initial vote was taken. What was the result?
The initial vote was a split vote. There were two votes for Molly Miller. That was Councillor Tolley and Councillor Zagara. And then there were two votes for Jack Rubin, which were Councillor Parisian and myself.
Okay. And I have a recollection that after that happened, Mayor Dickey made some comment, which is, I knew I was going to get stuck being the tiebreaker, or something to that effect. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And to be honest, I thought that might be the case, you know, before we got in the meeting, and I had reached out to see if there was some interest on, you know, not putting the mayor on the spot, right? Look, I get it. That's a really awkward situation. I have to consider the person that you ran against. But given the tightness of the vote and the record turnout, like, you know, to me, there was a pretty good case to be made for, you know, sort of an olive branch. And I don't fault Ryan for not making that choice. I mean, I would have really struggled with it myself. You know, so it's it was a difficult situation.
And just again, just to make sure we get all the facts out, there was the way the election has to work under state law, as I understand it, you went through the first ballot. Was 2-2. Ryan broke the tie. Then you had to do the same thing again a second time. Right?
Yeah, and I don't think the tie-breaking vote was on the first round. I think the split vote caused us to go to a second round where Ryan broke the tie. I could be wrong on that, but the result was still. The result's still the same.
Yeah, I mean, as I recall, the second vote came immediately after the first vote. There was
correct.
Not like a break and more argument or anything like that to
correct.
Any significant extent.
Discussion. I wouldn't call it argument, Roger.
Okay. From my lawyerly
yes.
background, I
yes.
tend to see discussions and arguments as often being very similar. Once again, let's talk a little bit more about why you ended up where you ended up.
Look, I think last night I was pretty honest. Well, not pretty. I think I was very honest with my comments. I'm happy to move forward, you know, as a full, you know, council with whoever is up there with me. You know, I did vote for Jack, in the election. And that's not a ding against Ryan. You know, I like Ryan. I think Ryan actually I feel there's a bit of a void on council. I think Ryan was a really good counselor and, you know, intelligent and really brought, you know, an A game in terms of thinking to the council. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of a void that he left, in acceding to the mayor's role. So I would have been super happy with Ryan still as a colleague on council. I'm happy with Ryan as a mayor. We get along well, and I told him last night that I will, you know, operate transparently and honestly with him and tell him exactly how I feel. So for me, you know, I voted for Jack in the election. So and you know, he did get 1,699 votes, 49.9% of the vote. So how could I not support? Right. So that for me, it was I was trying to reflect the will of the people and make sure that the people that, you know, felt that they didn't have some representation, you know, felt that they did have some representation.
For those of us who were in the room or watching it on the Zoom, it was evident that this vote created some tension within the council. It was not exactly there was irritation and concern. My question for you is, do you think it's going to affect the working relationship going forward? Do you think this?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. I would say, from my perspective, not at all. You know, and sure, there was a bit of tension. I think just around the awkwardness of the situation, which probably speaks to, you know, I know it's state law that's how we do it, but you know, maybe we want to spend some of our lobbying time at the state to allow for a special election to let the people actually have that decision. But that's, you know, that's a longer conversation. But you know, I didn't normally if there were tension, like I would have, my stomach would have reacted and I would have had to take a time out and run to the men's room. That did not happen.
Okay.
So, you know, I feel pretty good about the result. And look, Molly's a fine individual. And I had met with Molly previously on a couple of occasions, most recently, maybe about 6 weeks ago. And I went up to her after the meeting and I said, look, you know, how I chose to view this is not a judgment on you. It's a judgment on what I felt was the right thing to do.
Okay. interesting. A special election. The special election would be an interesting thing, although it would take a lot of time. In other words, you know, you'd be without a council member for a matter of weeks, if not months.
Well, we were with, we are without a council member for a couple of weeks, but if you ran the special election the first week of January,
I guess you could do it that fast.
We probably could do something like that.
Okay, we're talking about the legislature a little bit here, and that sort of takes us to the next big item on the agenda, in a sense. And the next big item on the agenda was the issue of whether or not the city would enter into a consent agreement with Matthew Prince about the construction of his home above Old Town. First of all, can you sort of frame the issue that was in front of you?
Yeah, sure. And I can't get into super detail on this, Roger, as you can probably appreciate as a lawyer, because there still is pending litigation. Fortunately, the city was able to settle with this consent agreement with the Prince family. Resolve the litigation that was between the city and the Prince family. The way I view it is we had a planning commission approval for the home. We had a historic design review from our planning director, our professional planning director, who we have great trust and faith in her capabilities. And, I felt at this point, you know, after nearly 4 years of this going on, that it was in our best interest to figure out a way to move forward and allow for some opportunity for the community to move forward and try to create some healing on this. I don't like inviting more scrutiny of our historic district capability that we have. We're one of four municipalities in the state that have that ability. The state is not granting new historic district designations around the state. They've actually clamped down on that a bit. So why keep poking that bear and invite more scrutiny? Let's protect our historic Old Town District, the 25-foot by 75-foot lots, that fabric of that early mining age, and the Sweeney MPD stands kind of on its own in some respects, I just felt it was the right thing to do in terms of protecting the city.
And just for our listeners who, and a lot of people feel very passionate about this issue, felt that the city should, quote, stand up, end quote, and protect the code as written. What I'm hearing from you is really there were these two factors. One was, as you and the council looked back at the record of what happened here, what happened at the Planning Commission, what happened at the Board of Adjustment, that your analysis was, okay, this one probably meets the code requirements and taken as a whole should be approved. Is that am I overly simplifying that part of the analysis?
No, you're not oversimplifying it. And look, there are people that are not going to be happy with that design. There are people, we don't hear from the people that actually think it is a good design. You can imagine what it would be like to give public comment saying you support that design. I think the important thing is there were a number of conditions of approval, right? A long list. There was reasonable give on the part of the applicant on the approval. The city did not concede on several items, which are in the conditions of approval. We got them to change the glazing of the windows, the roof lines, and then we also were able to get additional mitigation as part of the consent agreement in terms of additional landscaping to screen and minimize the impact of the view from Old Town. And the new rendering shows a substantial shield of vegetation and trees and shrubbery, which will really do a good job. And like, I can't put a dollar number on that. We won't know how much of this is going to cost, but it's a significant investment to do that additional. Plus we got some additional public safety and investment up there in terms of a fire hydrant and that stuff. So,
okay. So that's piece one of the analysis. Yep. And piece two of the analysis, which you sort of alluded to, is a concern that were the city to turn this down, were it to go through the litigation path, that there was a possibility that the legislature would take a harder look at our sort of historic district designation. And more importantly, we've seen the legislature in recent years not be all that reluctant to undermine local control. Was that out there?
Yeah, look, local control is important, but part of that is knowing you know, what's the line from the song "The Gambler"? You got to know when to
when to hold them, when to fold them.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say that we folded. I think we made a calculated decision. My entire career, 25 plus years in finance, was all about risk management. I learned a lot in that 25 years. And for me, this was about risk management. And I felt like, you know, I don't want to jeopardize our ability to protect our historic district over this, where it is at this point in time.
Anything else from last night, or can we talk about 248?
No, nothing else from last night. I just want to, you know, thank all of the community that showed up and gave public comment. I know it was a difficult, it was a difficult meeting for all of us up there. But you know, sometimes, this job requires difficult work. So thank you for everyone for showing up.
And 248 comes back next week.
Yes.
The issue that never leaves us.
Yeah, exactly.
And we just had an interesting conversation with Mayor Ralph Savarini about some of the things that are going on in Hideout that will affect 248. Let's talk about the agenda item. What's the agenda item for next week?
So the agenda item, the staff is coming back to us, and they were before us a week ago to talk about to give us an update on the 248. The movement is towards selecting a locally preferred alternative, which they'll refer to as an LPA.
Gotta have initials.
It's exactly. My wife, everything my wife has done has involved acronyms, so I've gotten very good at decoding acronyms. So we need to pick a locally preferred alternative. That doesn't mean that that is absolutely what's going to happen. It just means that we can go to the next step in terms of planning and due diligence and vetting of whatever it is that we choose to move forward with. It doesn't mean that, you know, that locally preferred alternative could be found to not work out at some point in the future, and then we go back and grab something that we left back in the bucket. And what I want to stress is, differently from the 224 BRT, 248 is Park City's project. We have, you know, and it may be for the first time ever that UDOT has signed a charter, basically agreeing with the city on what the sort of the steps and what the process is on this. So this is our project. You know, we, at the end of the day, it's UDOT's corridor, but they've said we're willing to be a really good partner and help Park City achieve whatever they want to achieve in terms of serving the community.
So what are the options on the table that you'll be looking at on Tuesday?
Primarily right now we're looking at either a bus rapid transit in the corridor. And, when I hear bus rapid transit, sometimes I have a little bit of a I giggle a little bit about that, because the buses can't go faster than what the speed limit is. So if you consider, 35 miles an hour rapid, then that's fine.
If you've been on 248 at 8:30 on a powder day, you would think that was very rapid.
No, I would agree. And and then the other thing is we're also looking at center running light rail transit doing a center lane sort of protected on 248, which would require, whatever we choose is going to require widening that footprint. And if you think about it, with a widened footprint, it still could be a blank canvas. You could choose to do one or the other. So
when you start talking about light rail and you, obviously, I see dollar signs, obviously light rail is not cheap, especially as compared to an extra bus lane. Where could that funding come from?
That funding could come from a variety of sources, but most specifically from the state and from the federal government.
Part of the Olympic buildup?
Yeah,
indirectly.
But yes, like there are the calls to invest in infrastructure, as there were before 2002, and the Front Runner, which was built prior to the Olympics in 2002, was funded. That first phase of the Front Runner was 80% funded by the federal government. I think it was a $686 million project, and the federal government paid 80% of that. So There are opportunities. We have to have a conviction and an ask, and do our best to make it rain in terms of having the federal money come in.
And if I could go into the back room of the Bill Sirocco planning room and I could say, okay, what do you want to see happen?
Well, look, I think if anyone's familiar with me, I here's my viewpoint. I want us to be able to have a transportation mode that allows us to influence behavior. And by influence behavior, I'd love to see less cars coming into Park City. And I mean dramatically less, like thousands less. And in order to do that, you have to have a mode of transportation that is fast and dense enough in terms of seats per ride to make that happen, to conveniently, because you can't force people to do that or incentivize them to do that unless you give them a better, faster, more reliable option.
Okay. 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You're 2 years into your term.
Yeah.
I want you to look back really briefly and answer me two questions. What was the most surprising thing, and what do you like best?
Oh, God, most surprising thing.
I surprised you with the question.
Yeah, exactly. So surprising, I'll just say that, I thought this role would be difficult. I thought that I would feel conflicted at times. I'm surprised at how difficult it has been and how conflicted I've felt at times.
Okay. And I suppose that's also the hardest thing, isn't it?
We answered
both questions with one answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Bill Scirocco from the Park City Council, thanks for spending time with us this morning. The Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW, and we'll be right back after this. Okay, the Olympic squad for BUSA Biathlon has been set, and the athletes will soon be off to the Anterselva Biathlon Arena in Italy. Here with an update on USA Biathlon is CEO Jack Gearhart. Good morning, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Roger. How are you?
I am doing great. I have to tell you, as I was getting ready for this interview, I was remembering my own experience during the 2000 Olympics and how my wife said, hey, we've got these tickets to the biathlon. And I said, that doesn't sound like it was very interesting. Be very interesting. And I went, and it was fabulous. And it was fabulous. It was one of my favorite events of the Olympics. So let's start by sharing with a little bit of our listeners about how the biathlon works and why it's such an amazing spectator sport.
Yeah, it's great. It is fascinating to watch. So biathlon is a combination of cross-country skiing and marksmanship, shooting a 22 rifle. And there are 11 events in the Olympics. There's 12 in the broader World Cup competition, and it's a mix of sort of shorter distance races, longer distance races, relays, single sex relays, and mixed sex relays as well. So it's they really mix it up. There's also a race that's called the Pursuit, which is based on starting times or based on finish times of a sprint race. So the winner of the sprint is the first to start in the Pursuit, and the second to start is the second finisher in the sprint, and they start so many seconds back of how they finished in the sprint race. So it's really interesting, and what makes the sport, I think, fascinating is, you know, there's strategy and tactics as far as the skiing goes, and how athletes will draft behind each other and when they make the move to pass one another. But then there's this whole element of the shooting.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are athletes that are, you know, hardcore endurance athletes. They're hard speeding at 180 or 190 beats a minute. And they then have to come to a standstill, either laying prone or standing, and shoot at these targets that are 50 meters away. And it's just this, the sort of dichotomy here, if you will, of this endurance sport where you're just pushing and pushing and pushing, and then you have to stop and have this just intense precision to shoot these targets. It's incredible. And what you see happening is the lead changes, because somebody will come in, they'll be behind, and they'll just have an incredible time on the range, hit all the targets, be fast, and they'll jump into the front. And then you'll have people and athletes that are leading with what looks like a really healthy lead, and they'll miss shots, go into the penalty loop, and they're all of a sudden out of the running. So it's like the race is never over until the last athlete is across the finish line.
You know, that idea, you know, for those of us whose endurance sports sort of are limited to riding the exercise bike or skiing a Mogul Hill, but the idea of skiing a Mogul Hill and then stopping and trying to be steady enough to fire a target, to fire a rifle at a target 50 meters away, it must take an extraordinary sort of mental, it's a combination of mental and physical disciplines to be able to steady yourself after that intense ski run between the targets.
Absolutely. I mean, our coaching staff is a real mix of, you know, endurance, cross-country ski technique coaches, shooting coaches. Our shooting coach, Matt Emmons, is a gold medalist from Team USA in shooting. And then we have, you know, a team of sports psychologists that are coaching and working with the athletes, and that mindset when you come in and capturing and hitting that last target is something that is just, it's incredibly challenging, and it's amazing when it's when they pull it off. There's a real lot of things that these athletes are thinking about.
So Jack, many of our listeners, particularly, you know, here in the Park City area, many of our listeners are very familiar with the pipeline whereby we develop Olympic athletes for skiing. Can you talk a little bit about your pipeline? How do you develop the biathletes of tomorrow?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that we've been working on pretty extensively over the last several years. We in 2020-2021, U.S. Biathlon drafted basically a 10-year strategic plan. And I think for the first time, they really put a lot of focus in on the development, the grassroots, and the pipeline, like you were talking about. And basically what is happening today is there's a mix of ways that athletes get involved in the sport. There's a mix of on-ramps, if you will. Mm-hmm. You have athletes that are cross-country skiing and competing in biathlon from an early age because they are living near venues that have ranges and the sports are there in front of them. And we have, you know, several athletes that have been biathletes for, you know, basically their entire sports career. What's happening now and that we've spent a lot of time working on is athletes that have been Nordic skiers and competing in that realm, getting them introduced to the sport and competing in both, and then coming over and transitioning into cross-country skiing. So there's some of these athletes that pick up a rifle a little bit later in their athletic career and find that they really like this balance of precision and endurance. And one of the programs that we've launched, we've actually been running it for quite a while, but is identifying really talented, fast cross-country skiers and introducing them to biathlon. And it's not an either or, it's like, hey, you can do both. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of athletes right now, two of our women that are going to the Olympics, Margie Fried and Lucy Anderson, both came into biathlon that way through recruiting that we did. And Lucy, in fact, this year has skied on both the cross-country World Cup and is competing in the biathlon World Cup. I was just going to say that, you know, at the grassroots level where there are not ranges around, we've introduced a laser rifle.
That was what I wanted
program.
To ask you next. But okay. How significant is the laser rifle?
Well, we see that as a huge opportunity to get young athletes familiar with the sport. The laser rifles that are being used are very similar to the live fire rifles from a weight perspective, from a look perspective. And, you know, they're shooting at a target that's 10 meters away. There's no ammunition, no live fire, so there isn't any, you know, issues around having to have these massive venues set up. And we are able to set these up. John Farah, who is a native of the area there, lives down in Heber, is our sport development director, and he launched this program several years ago. He takes a couple of laser rifles to Nordic events and sort of sets up demos for the athletes to try. Mm-hmm. And they love it. They absolutely love it. And we're connecting with probably about 2,500 kids a year doing this through Nordic competitions, through school programs, through expos and things like that. And it's giving them that first taste of it. And from there, athletes are finding opportunities to continue that. We have that program, Tri-Biathlon, I think we have about 30 laser rifles that are constantly moving across the country for these events. And then last year, John worked with four Nordic clubs in Montana and Colorado, and I think California, where he shipped them 10 laser rifles for about a four-week period. And along with that, a curriculum and a program on how to integrate biathlon into their Nordic programs. And these clubs, for 4 weeks, they all their young athletes participated in this biathlon program.
So,
and
Jack, I'm
They really loved it.
Jack, I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. One yes or no question. Never won an Olympic medal yet. Is this going to be the year?
It is going to be the year.
All right.
We are in a great spot right now. Our athletes are, they have the capabilities of doing it. You know, Campbell Wright won two medals last year at the World Championships. And we're in a really good spot. We've had a best start to the season, I think, than we've ever had.
Okay, Jack,
and
I
the athletes
catch you
are
off.
Really pumped.
Thanks for joining us this morning. We'll be right back after this.
Film executive David Lind will become the Sundance Institute's next CEO February 17th, according to the nonprofit's announcement Thursday. Board member Amanda Kelso has been acting chief executive since Joanna Vicent stepped down from the role after the 2024 Sundance Film Festival. Lind says he's honored to join the nonprofit, calling it essential to independent art, creatives, and the broader culture. He says he looks forward to working with staff and artists to advance the Institute's programs and the annual film festival, which is moving to Boulder, Colorado, starting in 2027. Institute Board Chair Ebs Berno says Lind brings a rare combination of industry fluency, social cause management, and deep commitment to artists. Lind was CEO of Participant Media for almost a decade before the production company known for Spotlight, An Inconvenient Truth, and Green Book shut down in 2024. Since then, he's been an independent consultant. Lind has also been Universal Pictures chairman and co-founded Focus Features. He was a partner at the film studio Good Machine and CEO and owner of Lava Bear Films. The 2026 Sundance Film Festival arrives in Park City January 22nd and departs February 1st. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.